Hello to everyone listening. My name is Sami Merdinian, and together with Ian Lowe, we would like to welcome you to Down the Pit and the second part of our interview with pianist Philip Edward Fisher. As always, we want to thank you for listening week after week. And if you haven't done so, please subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this podcast. Please share with friends that are musicians, music lovers, or just would like a little sneak peek to the artist's minds and the behind the scenes of the industry. For those that would like to contribute to the podcast, for as little as 99 cents a month, you can visit anchor.fm and our profile Down the Pit to make your pledge. If you or anyone you know would like to advertise with us, please send us an email to admin@downthepit.com. Thank you, and enjoy the second and final part of our interview with Philip.
We would like to thank our corporate sponsor, US Pave. For any and all your commercial and residential paving needs, please visit us at uspave.com. US Pave, the national paving company.
Here, back with Philip. Let's answer that question that we left trickling last week.
The cliffhanger.
Is there a breaking moment in your career, or do you believe in a breaking moment?
This is as much of a cliffhanger for me as it was for the listener. I sort of believe in a series of breaking moments, but I can pinpoint, I wouldn't say it's a career moment, it's more like a performing moment, it's more like a development moment, I think, because it's going back quite a long way, like into my teens. But I remember there was a particular performance. It was at the Purcell Room, actually on the South Bank. It's part of the South Bank Centre in South London. It was part of it. They would do this at Purcell School every year. They sort of, you'd audition to, say, like three or four people would be part of this recital. So it was like giving you experience on like a really big stage. I remember I'd been working on this like particular concept with my teacher, and actually it's quite related to what I was talking about in the previous episode about subconscious and being in the zone on stage. Because I think before that, and this actually might even relate to the other question you had about certain technical things, I think because I sort of jumped a few hurdles, if you will, and then I was like performing in a way before I really was entitled to, in a way, you know what I mean? I think there were certain things, like I might have been a bit too calculating about things and just like making sure I just got every note right and just being like very perfectionist about things. And my teacher at the time, Christopher Elton, had been really trying to get me to be what he would almost call like out-of-body experiences, where you're almost like observing yourself performing, so you don't feel so much like you're present, but you're more just like you're letting your body do it.
Existentialism.
I think it's something that's talked about more in sports. You know, they like sports people talk about being in the zone, almost like they're not thinking about it. And I was kind of like really struggling to get it with him. I didn't quite know what he was talking about. And there was like a bit of frustration over it. And then I remember I was in this performance, Purcell Room. I was maybe 15 or 16, something like that. And I was playing, I think it was Chopin's third sonata, and I was playing the slow movement, which is just one of my all-time favorite pieces to play. It's one of the most beautiful, like, meditative things you could hear. And I remember something happened in that performance where I suddenly just, like, had this feeling of, like, I wasn't thinking so much. It was just, like, this really amazing, almost, like, meditative, you know, like, out-of-body experience. And it's kind of like, wow, that was really crazy. And then the amazing thing was my teacher came backstage, and the first thing he said to me was, he just looked at me and he said, that was the first time you ever got it.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool.
That was pretty powerful because it made a certain connection where it's like, you know, you question something that a teacher tells you. You're like, does it really make a difference to the listener? Does anyone really know? You know, you have these questions, but to actually have like a tangible, before I could say anything, I didn't say to him like, that felt amazing. He just said, yep, you got it there.
You transcended the instrument.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that really stuck with me. Because I wasn't seeking it. I mean, I was seeking it in lessons, in training, but I wasn't seeking it in that moment. It wasn't like I stepped out on the stage and said, tonight I'm going to try and do it. It just happened. And it was like something that like clicked. Yeah, I remember that for a long time. I actually use it in my own teaching as well, because I always say to students, it's not something that you can actively find, because you'll never know where to look. You've just got to be open to it happening to you. And then once it's happened, you make that mental connection. And I think the fact that he recognized it, it made that connection. And now, to this day, I still don't try to seek it, because I know it's like, it's not something that you can actively seek. You've just got to allow it to happen. And I think as performers, you guys would probably agree with this, that it might happen to you 50% of the time if you're lucky on stage. I don't know, maybe you guys have different...
I don't know the percentage, but...
You know, you would probably say that most of the time it isn't fully happening. It's like that zone is like so rare.
Or it can happen at moments during a performance, but to find a full performance like that, it's super hard.
Yeah, exactly. That isolated moments. And I don't think you're ever going to find it from the beginning to the end of a performance. It just doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. It's more like you're kind of just allowing yourself to experience it, or to let it find you in a way, if that, that makes any sense. That was a really big moment, and it stuck with me. It's one of those things that you sort of just, you never forget.
That leads me to my next question. We're talking about different mindsets. When you're performing solos and recitals and concertos and chamber music and other types of collaboration, is there a different mindset that you have? Are you always trying to be in this existentialism?
There definitely is a different mindset when you're performing with others, because you've got to be attuned to them as well as just yourself. Then you're like in a whole new area where you're sort of, you've got to have both the conscious and the unconscious going on at the same time in a way. It's like you just got to be more attuned to what's going on. And it can be something as simple as like you get slightly out of sync with your partner and you've got to find a way. So you've always got to know when they're looking for it from you and vice versa. And then interestingly, I think that informed the way I play concertos, because, you know, when you're younger, you tend to think of concertos as like you're still a solo thing. Yeah. And then I think the more that you do chamber music and the more that you get attuned to just hearing other people, that's when you start to understand that like a concerto is just as collaborative, because there can be a solo that comes out and you've got to switch from being the main guy to suddenly sort of sitting back and accompanying somebody in the orchestra. I think that again is a different thing. You've got to have both that mentality of I'm driving this in a way, but I've also got to know when to be driven too. You know, it's so, yeah, I think they're all different. I think, you know, they all have that like base of you've got to find that subconscious zone, but in a different way. I think in some ways I actually almost prefer collaborative stuff, concertos, chamber music, for that reason. There's nothing quite like the rush of experiencing it, and you know other people are experiencing it on stage at the same time.
Does it take out some responsibility?
Yeah, funny. I mean, you feel less lonely, right? You feel less like it's all on you.
Yeah.
You know, it's more of a teamwork. It's almost like the difference between being maybe like playing tennis and then playing soccer with a team, or playing billiards where it's like really you. You know, it's like your visit to the table and it's all on you. I think in a way that I was probably drawn to billiards because of that, because I have that mentality of like, this is on me. But then, you know, then sometimes I, like, say you play in a league then at Amsterdam Billiards and suddenly you're on a team. And then you're like, oh, okay, this shot means something to my team now. It doesn't just mean something to me. So it is a different thing. It probably increases your feeling of responsibility, but less pressure in a sense, because you're kind of sharing that responsibility. It's strange. It's like on the one hand, you're still that individual. You just have that sense, well, you know, we're in this together. If it sucks, it's...
the ship is sinking.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and if it's great, we all sort of share that together.
So, Philip, the New York Sun says you are a new music specialist. Is new music a passion of yours, or do you prefer the classics?
New music is a huge passion for me. I've always played it. So I was working with Philip Martin, Irish composer-pianist, super talented pianist and amazing composer. I started playing his stuff, you know, and he actually wrote me a little piece, and then he would give me scores to his music, like handwritten scores, and he'd write little notes on them and all this sort of stuff. So I was sort of really in that idea of like knowing the composer and playing their stuff and like what the pleasure that can give you. And so I've just always done it, and I've been like really lucky. I also connected with a Scottish composer called Ronald Stevenson, who was very big in the UK, wrote one of the longest running pieces. It's like constantly running for about 90 minutes. It's called a Passacaglia on DSCH, the Shostakovich theme.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it just builds up from the theme, and it just gets bigger and bigger. It's like one of the most incredible things. I actually recorded something of his when he was sick. He just had a stroke, and my teacher said, would you record something for Ronald Stevenson? And I recorded a piece of his, which my teacher then sent to him when he was sick. And then he liked it so much and appreciated it so much, he wanted to meet me. So he when he came down to Birmingham, we actually got together and I played it for him in person. So I remember just like really early experiences of knowing the composer and just how kind of fulfilling that was. You know, you're no longer just playing the music of someone that you have to channel, yeah. in a sense, but, and then you're suddenly working with people. And then if I take that through up until the present day, one of the projects that I've just finished actually recording is the complete piano music of John Carigliano. I recorded his piano concerto with the Albany Symphony and David Alan Miller back in 2019, actually. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. The plan was always to record all the solo stuff too, which I was lucky enough to be able to do just at the beginning of the year at Adelphi University. They very kindly sort of more or less donated the space. Steinway donated an instrument. It was, you know, so finally got to sort of finish that complete project. It should be coming out on Naxos, waiting for the first edit. But it'll be the piano concerto and the complete solo works. So working with him was just incredible. I mean, the guy is a genius, he's a living legend.
Yep.
The music is amazing. And actually, one of the things that really stuck out to me, I remember going to his apartment, and I'd already met him in places, so I sort of knew him, but we hadn't yet become really close mm-hmm. the way we are now. We were very close friends. And I remember going to his apartment on West End Avenue and walking into his music room and seeing the Oscar, so the, you know, the Grammy Award for the Red Violin,
yeah.
and multiple, not the Oscar Award, the Academy Award, multiple Grammys, framed records with, you know, Daniel Barenboim and Chicago Symphony, and just like, and, you know, sort of
yeah.
every, and I was just, I remember just thinking, Jesus, you know, that sort of, almost like intimidation factor,
mm-hmm.
and this was the first time I was going to play his music for him.
No pressure now.
Yeah, no pressure. But it couldn't, it just couldn't have been a better experience. He was just totally supportive and just loving the fact that someone is playing his music, you know? And it's, mm-hmm. that's when you sort of realize that this guy's a legend, but they still want their music played,
yeah.
and it's still a collaboration. You know, it wouldn't exist without us as performers, and it definitely wouldn't exist without them. As
he was probably very excited of what you personally would bring to
yeah.
his music.
And then what was really fascinating through the whole project was very often he'd say, you know, I used to think this way about that passage, and now I feel this way about it. And then there were even some orchestration things he changed, which are now in the new engraved score of the concerto. So yeah. it's still yeah. Yeah. a work in process in that way. It's like that's how you sort of realize that music isn't this like set in stone thing.
Right.
It's still yeah. kind of like living and breathing. And maybe if a composer could come back from the past, they might feel differently about it. So it was just a really interesting experience, because then you sort of, you think about what that means about the idea of period performance, or what mm-hmm. that means about the idea of channeling the composer's intentions, because we always, you know, we hear that a lot, right? Sort of be true to the score, do what the composer wanted. But maybe on some level, the composer might have felt something different later. And yeah. So I found that was like a really illuminating experience for me, just to see how it can still change and evolve mm-hmm. for the guy that created it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, not just us as performers.
So that kind of kept you busy recording this during COVID?
Yeah.
Any other things that you did?
Yeah, so actually directly related to COVID, this was very much my first project after going through the pandemic and actually having been really sick with COVID, because I got it in March of last year. I'd just come back from London, I think around March 10th, I started getting sick about a week later, and then I went through a...
So that's the week that everything closed here in New York?
Basically, just as it closed down, yeah. And then I didn't leave my studio apartment for, you know, 21 days.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I was really sick for about a month, every symptom under the sun. I was never sick enough to go to the hospital, though I look back and I think I might have on a couple of occasions, but I really didn't want to. Yeah, I'd somehow, for some reason, whatever reason, I got it really badly, unusually probably, like for the age range and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, in the middle of it, I get a call from a composer friend of mine who lives in London by the name of Richard Thomas, who probably would be most famous here for Jerry Springer, the opera. Do you remember when that was? They were doing that at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
So Richard was the composer for that. He also wrote the libretto for the Anna Nicole Smith
uh-huh.
opera that they did at BAM, I think. And I knew Richard through mutual friends in London. I'd done a couple of other sort of things with him, and he's amazing. He's one of the funnest guys. Incredible, like, improviser. He'll sit and improvise a song about you, make up the lyrics on the spot, and completely roast you. It's just like, his mind just works this way. Anyway, so he got in touch with me, and it turned out that he was really battling COVID as well. He had it really badly. He was locked down in London. I was locked down in New York. And he said, I'd heard you had it through mutual friends. And we were really just like comparing symptoms and experiences. And then he suddenly gets in touch with me and he says, oh, I've had this commission from the Guggenheim Museum for their works and process virtual commissions. They want me to write something. And he said, I'm thinking of writing the COVID-19 variations. And he was like, I want to write them for you. Would you perform them if I do? I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like if we can find a venue and a way to do it. You know, we were both still sick at this time. So he just started sending me movements. And they were, at first it was like funny things like quick turn on CNN was like one of the movements. And the first movement is BC before COVID, which has this like Broadway stuff going on because I think it was like a precursor to the idea of like Broadway getting shut down. And then there's all these like stir crazy is another movement. Oh, and then he does this like series of movements that say things like, I'm going to learn a new language. I'm going to exercise every day. And then the next movement is, but first I'm getting Netflix. It's like, and then the next movement is like deciding between Scarface or Frozen 2. But then it suddenly just takes this turn and it goes into like the experience of actually having the virus. So it goes from this humorous kind of like idea of the humorous aspects to lockdown and what we were all experiencing to actually the idea of having the virus. So then there's movements like going under, fever night, please don't end me is probably one of the most poignant ones. Yeah, so it just suddenly really just changes. And then the last movement is AC, after COVID, with a question mark, because it's like that idea of when is it going to end? You know,
exactly,
sort of,
yeah.
The whole thing sort of ends on the question mark. It's a really powerful experience, and I'm not just giving myself a shameless plug here, but it's on YouTube, and it was through the Guggenheim Works and Process. I think if you went to their page, but if you just Googled, you know, COVID-19 variations or Philip Edward Fisher, Richard Thomas, we recorded it at Adelphi University again, very kindly just gave me their hall, which is this fantastic hall, beautiful Fazioli piano, great friend of mine, Louis Panullo, provided the cameras. He has an amazing set of cameras. We brought in a sound guy. Lewis's daughter, Ashley, did the editing for me. I mean, it was this amazing, like, team effort of friends to get this thing done. It was like, how do we get this done in COVID time? And it's in this completely empty hall, which is somehow apt and kind of has its own poignant sort of feeling to it. So, yeah, they was commissioned and they put it out at the Guggenheim Museum. And it's a really affecting, powerful piece. And it was a really amazing experience for me because it was like usually you're playing a piece and you sort of have to make up a narrative for yourself or a story or how do I channel these feelings or emotions. And suddenly he was just like sending me pieces where it's like I started playing and I'm like, I experienced this. Mm-hmm. And he experienced it. And I knew exactly what he was getting at. It was just like, I know exactly the feeling he's going for there. And that was really amazing because I didn't have to think about it. I was just like, Richard, you've just shared your experience with me like through music. So that was really amazing. That was like a kind of being part of the process. You know, and he would send me one or two things, but do you think this works? This and you know, some things we left out, some things we brought in. It was a challenging project because I think it brought up a lot of ideas of how much humor can you inject into this before it gets tasteless. And obviously you've got to bear in mind what was really going on and like what this really meant and literally losing so many people. But I think it manages to do both. I think it manages to give that light relief of kind of like joking a little bit about lockdown itself because we were all going through that and we all had to find ways to deal with it and to cope with it. But then it very much just changes direction and I think it becomes a very monument in a way to like the whole experience. So it's really amazing. And we're currently working on producing it in different places in the UK. I think Guggenheim Museum want to do a live performance of it eventually, hopefully in the fall. Got some different ideas of including visual art into it. There's a artist called Alison Jackson from the UK, and she's creating short films to each of the movements that we're hoping to present at a theatre in Birmingham. We've had some ideas about bringing in actors to play out some of the themes, so it's going to keep going. Richard calls it a piano drama. And it's almost like a genre that he's invented.
We just heard three of the movements of the COVID-19 variations, performed by Philip Edward Fisher, composed by Richard Thomas. First, we heard BC, before COVID, followed by Fever Night, and finally AC, after COVID, question mark.
So, Philip, as a musician, certain musicians cannot speak publicly, so they use their instrument to do the talking. You can do both well. Do you like to talk in front of audiences?
Yeah, I really love it, actually. I don't find it's appropriate in all settings or venues. It would be difficult in Carnegie Hall, if you had a mic, maybe. But it's not to say that you shouldn't. I find it just particularly good in like more intimate settings. I can think of like somewhere like Barge Music in Brooklyn, or even if you're doing like house concerts. I really love it just because I think it just kind of gives you a connection to the audience. They start to feel involved even before you've started playing. And sometimes it can just be as simple as like giving them one little thing, like a hook almost, to like listen for. And I think it really changes the listening experience. I've often got a lot of feedback from people about that. I love that you pointed this out because it really changed my experience of listening. I was kind of like, oh, there it is. You know. And I think that might be something that's kind of a bit lost in the classical music world and probably exists more naturally in the pop music world, because people are often presenting original music, right? And often tell the story of why they wrote that song, let's say, right? So you just immediately have that kind of personal connection where you sort of see the artist and the performer, the music and the experience all like tied into one. And I think sometimes in classical music, we don't always have that. So I think that interaction for me is what just slightly changes that experience. I think it's really good for young people. And I think it's one thing that we can all do to bring younger audiences to classical music. I've had experiences, you know, where almost, I can remember one specific experience when I was in a house concert. And I think it just happened that the front row was almost like exclusively 15, 16 year olds, like parents that have brought their kids. And it was my own like prejudice where I'm kind of thinking, oh God, what are they going to think of this?
Here comes a cell phone going off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, how is this going to come across? And it happened to be a performance where we were combining Broadway with classical stuff. And it was like classics to Broadway. And it was a couple of like stars from Phantom of the Opera. And, you know, thinking, I haven't got a chance here. It's like, you know, these kids are just going to be like, these guys are cool and this guy's an idiot. Like, let's get out of here, you know. But that was my own, like, inner monologue, like, talking to me. But I think I was playing the Liszt transcription of the Liebestod from Tristan and Isolde of Wagner. Yeah. And I was tying in Wagner's idea of music drama and the idea of, like, it being something bigger where everything is tied in together, like the staging, the words, the music. It's all this one big experience, you know? And I was basically saying that musical theatre today probably wouldn't exist were it not for Wagner. You know, and then you can tie in, and I said, let's look at the theme of this stricken love between Tristan and Isolde. These themes you'll find in Phantom of the Opera, Les Mis, you know, whatever. You know, these are universal things that speak to everybody, but we hold them on a pedestal when it comes to, you know, Greek mythological stories, so kids are not going to understand them. You know, I think we underestimate young people. I probably was in my own way by thinking they're not going to respond to this. But amazingly, after the event, we were like having drinks around, and this group of kids came up to me and they were just like, that was unbelievable. Like, what was that? Tell us what that was again. Because like, after you told the story, like, it was amazing to hear how it came out in the music. And I thought, okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, we tend to underestimate young people. We tend to sort of think we've got to dumb something down or we've got to... But I don't think it is that. I think if you just say what it is and relate it to something that, you know, maybe they listen to and you can understand, just present it for what it is. It doesn't have to be crossover. It doesn't have to be dumbed down in some way. I think just show it for what it is. And I think they will respond to it.
Yeah, people rise to the occasion.
Yeah, they really do. So that was a really big moment for me because it taught me a lesson as well, like my own expectations or like prejudgments about what certain people would think. And then they were actually the ones that surprised me. It kind of taught me a lesson that I was the one who was being closed-minded and projecting that closed-mindedness onto them, you know, and kind of assuming that would come from them. Yeah, so that was like a lesson for me. And it doesn't just go for young people. I mean, it's like universal. I think anybody that's in the audience will get something from hearing from the performance. Somebody doesn't have to be life-changing. It's just, just something to kind of fill that personal element with the listening experience.
So speaking of lessons, is pedagogy something that you enjoy And do you teach at an institution or privately?
I don't teach in an institution. I do a lot of private teaching. Pre-pandemic, I started doing a sort of lecture education series at the Ramaz School on the Upper East Side, which is a Jewish school on the Upper East Side, which was supported by the Martin and Susan Sanders Foundation. They're friends of mine. They sort of brought me in to do that. That's been really amazing because they're sort of like lecture educational lessons. I did a couple of master classes. But yeah, I do a lot of private teaching, and mm-hmm. I get a huge amount of satisfaction from it. My students tend to be people who are already performing a little bit and they want to try something out, and I'm a little bit scared by the idea of teaching really young people. And so I think it's, for one thing, I think it's harder, and I actually think it's more of a skill in a way.
The Birmingham City guy is going to come out, huh?
Yeah, exactly. It's just, or just that you've just got to give them something so much more structured, more that that's something that kind of like develops. Whereas I feel I'm kind of more of a in the moment guy, where it's like, oh, if you're preparing for something, and I'll definitely give you the feedback. The thing I love doing more than anything is public masterclasses, because I love that interplay with the audience, and there's nothing more gratifying than if you do manage to change something and then you see the audience react.
Yeah.
To, oh yeah, that changed that. Yeah, because I think also for the young person performing, that's like another aha moment, you know, where it's like, oh, the audience are reacting to it. So yeah,
and you have like the added bonus that usually the second time they will play it a little better.
Yeah.
So you have like a little edge.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then you can just kind of like, you know, pat yourself on the back. Drop the mic.
He's like, that's it. My job here is done.
Job done. But yeah, I do. Pedagogy is really, really important to me. And I think it's something I'll do more. And I do see myself eventually, maybe an institution, performing less. I do see that as something mm-hmm. I would at like some, to do in the future, yeah.
Is there a common denominator that you feel you always need to talk about when talking to students in your master classes? What do you try to emphasize when you know you have maybe as little as 20 minutes or 30 minutes to work with them?
Yeah, I would say there's one thing that I almost always talk about. So there'll be some things which are like, each person will be different. You'll sort of notice like technical weaknesses or, you know, something you want to concentrate on. But to me, the common denominator is always, and it's going back to this whole thing about how do you perform. Mm-hmm. It's that idea of what technique really means and teaching technique in a way that is most efficient to produce the effect that you want out in the hall, as opposed to like if you're moving your fingers in the right way or if you're, you know, so, I mean, I think there's just certain physiological things, there's certain physics related things about producing sound on the piano, which are just undeniable. And I think with piano teaching, it can sometimes be a little bit based on the idea that we're trying to get away from the fact that it's a percussive instrument. I think as pianists, we're a little bit embarrassed mm-hmm. to admit that it's a percussive instrument. And so there's a lot of technical things which are sort of trying to mask over that fact. And I like to say, well, actually, no, accept it for what it is. And what's actually happening physiologically and with the physics? And what can you do to best affect how it's going to sound out in the audience? Even something like the idea of legato. I don't think legato, in terms of like connecting, I don't think it exists physically on the keyboard. Mm-hmm. It exists out in the hall. And you actually have to find ways to make it exist in the hall. And I think it's to do with this whole subconscious thing where I always say to a student, you know, by the time you've thought about how am I going to produce a sound, and it's left the instrument, and it's hit the back of the hall, and it's hit that wall, and then it's come back to your ear, and your brain has processed it, and then mm-hmm. you're hearing it. I was like, the moment is gone before you've even started, in a sense. That's your subconscious. Your conscious mind cannot keep up with that. There's just no way you're like computing mm-hmm. what I have to do physically for that to happen. Obviously, this is why you have the grind of training physically connected, you know, because you want to get to a point where you don't have to think about what you're doing physically so that you can unlock that subconscious. And I find that that is the common denominator for me, because I think that applies to absolutely everybody, mm-hmm. like regardless of where they are technically. If you can somehow incorporate that, I think it will always speak to anybody of any level. And I've seen amazing changes, and sometimes the psychology of it too. Because I think one of my main feelings, you know, I sight read pretty well because of the fact that I suddenly made that jump of like, oh, that's how you read music. And then I was just pulling out music into sight reading. Nobody ever stopped me. Mm-hmm. So it was like jumping in the deep end with no fear. in learning to swim, right? You yeah. better swim because you're going to drown if you don't. Yeah. It was like that feeling. So I never had that fear. Whereas I think sometimes with classical music teaching in particular, it's taught in a way that is focused on the avoidance of mistakes, the idea of a certain perfection, mm-hmm. and the idea of instilling almost that worry into young people. And I don't think jazz musicians have that. And I don't think pop musicians necessarily have that. It's like something that's really exclusive to the classical musician. And
everything has to be in tune and yeah, in time.
This idea that avoid those mistakes. And I say, mm-hmm. actually, no, make those mistakes.
And enjoy them.
Because I'm like, that's the only way you're ever going to learn. It's like analogous to learning to play tennis. You know, like you watch someone like Roger Federer. Everything is perfect. And yeah. then sometimes he'll just shank a shot so badly. It'll come off his rim and it'll fly up into the stand. Almost worse than anybody else.
Yeah,
I see him do that. When he does it, he really does it because he's so free and he's so operating within the absolute extremes of his limits, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So that when it's working, it's just unbelievable. But the one time when it just goes a little bit like it really goes wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important analogy because you have to know those extremes. If you've never let yourself go there, including making a horrible sound. You know, sometimes we're so worried about making a pretty sound. And I'm like, if you're only concerned with making a pretty sound, how do you know what a bad sound is?
Mm-hmm.
I remember a line from the amazing book by Heinrich Neuhaus, who was the teacher of Sviatoslav Richter, Emil Gilels, you know, like the greatest of the Russian school. And there's a line in it where he says, every great pianist from Horowitz to Richter to Gilels went through a period where they were so fond of bashing the piano, you couldn't be in the same room as them when they were playing. And I remember, like, it really stuck out to me.
I feel like that's a great idea for a festival.
Yeah, exactly.
Start banging.
Yeah, we could. Do you think we could sell that? But yeah, it just really stuck out to me because I thought, you know, those are people learning their parameters. Unless you do that. And he talks about the canvas of sound from silence to unlistenable, to unpleasant, mm-hmm. to like where it hurts. And he's like, that's actually your canvas and you're working within that. And there's your silence, and there's where it's unbearable. Let them make that mistake. They'll learn why that isn't the way at some point. You know?
When I was teaching band for middle school students, for the top group especially, I used to tell them, okay, pick a random note. They all used to look at each other like I was crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, here we go. And then I would conduct, and I'm like, just play that one note. And they would play it. It would sound horrible, right? It would be the worst, sounding like dying animals, right? And then I would be like, all right. Well, we're never going to do that again, are we? It's that lesson that you're talking about.
Like
allowing them to play a horrible note or make a cacophony of sound, and then they know what dissonance that's not supposed to be there sounds like, and you're allowing them to kind of fail on purpose, you know?
Exactly. I'm like a huge believer in that. And I think it really is a particular thing in classical music. And I just sort of count myself lucky in the sense that like I kind of skipped some of that because I just kind of went straight into this reading stuff and I was kind of out of control. And I'm sure I was just destroying the stuff that I was reading. I'm sure I was just massacring it. But I look back on it as the most important part of my development because I just literally,
absolutely.
Like, if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be where I'm sitting today where I don't have that fear about, you know, I've sight read on stage, I do it happily. And so people sometimes will ask me like, oh, well, where does that come from? And it's just pure luck. But it doesn't have to be luck. Because we can take those experiences as performers and say, well, how do you instill that in the youngest possible people? So it doesn't have to be luck. You know, mm-hmm. you sort of learn from your own experiences in that way.
So, Philip, before we move on to the second espresso, quick question.
Do I get an espresso with the espresso?
Well, do you need one? I mean, somebody's great
it'd
at making
it. It probably help the fast thinking, though.
Who was the most famous person you've met through performing?
I think probably Robert De Niro.
Okay. Oh, awesome.
The other one was probably Matt Damon. I got involved in a shoot. This was going back years ago. Do you know the movie The Good Shepherd?
Yeah,
which
course.
Was Robert De Niro directed it. So one day I just literally got a call from a friend at Juilliard saying, oh, they're looking for someone who's a pianist to also play a conductor for a film shoot. I didn't really know what it was all about. And they're like, would you be interested in doing it? And I was like, yeah, definitely. It sounds really cool. And then I got a call from the lady, I think she played in the New York Phil, and her side job was like contracting musicians for movies. And so she called me up and was like, oh, you're going to go down to this studio downtown for a screen test. Have you had conducting experience? I hadn't at the time, but I said, of course. You know, I'm one of them.
That's right.
Fake it till you make it type of thing. And she said, okay, so go down to this for the screen test. Still didn't really know what it was all about. Went down. This lady was there and she was like, I just want you to literally stand on the screen, say your name, say where you're from, say a little bit about yourself. So I did that, and then she was like, okay, I'm going to send that off to Bob. And I was like, you're going to send that off to who? She was like, to Bob De Niro. And I was like, what?
Bobby.
Like, okay, yeah, fine, you are short in the first name. So I was directing this movie, The Good Shepherd, and it was saw Matt Damon. It was about, like, I think the origins of the CIA, mm-hmm. I think, you know, and actually, funnily enough, it was a scene that was supposed to be at Yale University.
Mm-hmm.
I got booked for the session. They said, oh, yeah, Mr. De Niro, I'd like to do a video, or the look or whatever it was. They actually told me there was supposed to be some, like, look where I, like, bring in the orchestra, which they never happened. But you do see me down in the corner conducting this thing. And it was all mimed. It was all done on a track. And so Matt Damon was dressed in drag as Buttercup. He was supposed to be in this performance at Yale University. There's a point in the movie where the guys from the CIA, like, come backstage, and that's when they basically recruited this guy and into, like, the beginnings of the CIA and fighting communism, Cold War, and all this other stuff. And it was 2 days of just, like, the most grueling recording session for literally 30 seconds worth of film. And I had this basically a clip track. So everything was mimed. They just pre-recorded the music. But I had to bring in the orchestra. So all the other players who could mime convincingly uh-huh. to the music. So I was just literally, I would get two beats in my ear and then I'd have to bring it in and then start. And I was, like, faking the playing and conducting. So it was actually really high pressure because it was like, if I screwed up.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you said you had experience?
Yeah, exactly. Like, if I screwed up the pickup and they don't come in the time that, and it makes it...
That's why it took 2 days?
Convincing. No, I actually nailed it every time, just for the record. The reason it took 2 days was because Robert De Niro is the perfectionist of all time.
Oh, wow.
Wanted it done from every single conceivable angle. Kept on changing the lines, kept, now we do it like this, now I want a close-up of the timpani player. It was an insight, actually, into how hard these actors work. I was like, this is grueling. And it was like, you know, start really early hours, you know, like start like 5 a.m. kind of thing, like get the makeup on and do all the... I was like, okay, yeah, these guys do kind of earn their insane wages. But, you know, it is actually like really hard work. I was so impressed by, like, Matt Damon was doing this falsetto singing. Just, you know, 8 hours, just kept on doing it, delivering the same lines. Now do it in this way. So, yeah, it's probably Robert De Niro. And then Matt Damon after. They were both really friendly, you know, nice guys.
Do they still talk to each other, Matt Damon and Robert De Niro, after that?
I wonder.
Are you getting royalties for all that work?
Oh, God, I wish.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah, it was more like union scale. Although, actually, the reason they generally have you mime is because if the musicians genuinely play, you have to pay them. But yeah, it was really cool. Just get to meet those guys and feel like you're in it and get a insight into what it's like without actually having to have the pressure of ever doing it again.
Did you call him Bob or no?
No, I was just, I think it was like a Miko, Mr. De Niro.
Mr. De Niro, got it. Yep.
Makes love sense. Your movies. Yes. He was very friendly, like, just made you feel.
You have a picture with him?
I do, but it was like on my old flip, like, Motorola phone, and it's, you know, it's like...
pixelated.
Yeah, exactly. It's like really crappy photo. But...
All right, time for the second espresso.
Let's do it.
Rachmaninoff.
D minor.
Handel.
German, but not.
Beethoven.
Visceral.
John Axelrod.
Orchestra X.
Thomas Addis.
Amazing ear.
Ronald Stevenson.
Nicest guy you'll ever meet.
Philip Martin.
Second nicest guy you'll ever meet. Actually, sorry, Philip. That's a tie.
Joseph Kalickstein.
Teacher extraordinaire. So many ways.
Royal Scottish National Orchestra.
First real tour playing the same concerto over and over again, and that was not a one-word answer, and I apologize.
Apology accepted. London Symphony Orchestra.
Wish list.
Royal Academy of Music.
Development.
The Juilliard School.
Anti-development. Joke. Joke, by the way.
New York City.
Buzz.
John Corigliano.
Tour de force.
Red Violin.
Elegance.
Joseph Biden.
Relief.
Eric Adams.
Eric Adams. I have no response to that.
Prince Charles.
Supports culture.
Queen Elizabeth.
Always there.
Brexit.
Ugh.
Philip Edward Fisher.
Great podcasts.
Nice.
So, Philip, you love traveling and racking up those miles on the credit card to maintain the airplane. There you go, airplane status. Is that what you do if and when you have a free weekend or some free time or a free week? Or would you just, you know, rather stay home and relax?
Would I figure out my next mile strategy, you mean? yeah, I'd probably spend way too much time doing that, actually, to the point where I was like, I need to start this as like a service. Before the pandemic, I was really terrible at relaxing. I didn't kind of really know what that meant to just be at home and relax. Mm-hmm. I definitely got better at it. I never used to be like a guy that watched shows and like really got into it. I think that happened to all of us. Mm-hmm. Actually really now, maybe this is just my age, but I actually really look forward to just like sitting down at home, watching a show, glass of wine, beer or something like that. I almost fantasized at one point about like being the points pianist or something like that, like kind of strategizing for musicians, because I had this idea that as musicians, we need to be in good physical shape when we get to our destination. You know, sometimes you got to go straight into rehearsals. You know, so it isn't just about being spoiled and wanting luxury. Sometimes it is just like, give me that lie flat bed so that I'm not folded in two. Mm-hmm. You know, by the time I get to my first rehearsal. And so I sort of had this idea that I was kind of like, you know, so many of us musicians, that's what we need, but we don't necessarily have the means to do it, or it's not always like in a contract and all this sort of stuff. So I kind of made it my mission to find out ways, if it's like credit card bonuses or, you know, sort of like using upgrades with miles and all this sort of stuff, just as much as I could, just kind of making the travel thing just in a way, just like bearable at a certain point. I'm sure you can both relate to this, like when you're really doing it a lot. There comes a point where it's like it really is the difference between it just being comfortable. And then the other side of it is I have done a few kind of like bucket list experiences, like certain like Lufthansa first class. Me and my brother we sort of had a thing where we would, around Christmas time, we'd choose different destinations and just try to get there in like the most luxurious way possible for the least amount of money. And we did like Hong Kong in British Airways first class, and like Hawaii and United Polaris and all this sort of stuff. He's really great at it too. He just has he's probably better at it than me, actually. He has a spreadsheet which tells him where to like cancel the next credit card so that the next time can roll around where he can apply again and get the bonus.
There it is, yeah, 50,000 yeah, points.
That's like the serious strategy. I'm not quite that like organized about it, but yeah, it sort of just became a bit of a hobby. You kind of get a bit of a rush, I think, from like
finding deals.
Yeah, but it's almost like you're kind of like gaming the system a little bit. I remember there was one time I was like sitting in first class and it was Lufthansa. It's almost like they just can't do enough for you. It's like the service on Lufthansa is just unbelievable. And the guy was like coming up and he's like, oh, I must put away your bedding. And I was like, you know what? I was like, I can do that. I was like, you've done enough. And he's like, well, no, you know, you've paid enough for this. And I was like,
little do you know.
Yeah. The taxes actually weren't that high. <It's> like, but I guess in the sense you are paying for it because you are spending on the credit card and you are getting those. So,
and you spend the hours researching.
And you spend, yeah, exactly. You spend the hours researching. But it did become a sort of a bit of a hobby. But obviously, pandemic has put paid to that for a while.
Do you have any good piano jokes?
Not really, no. I mean, only if I kind of like equate them with like the best viola jokes, like, you know.
It's always
like, what's the best sound the piano can make, you know, splash or something like that. It's usually it's violas, but you know, I'm happy to throw it in with the piano. Piano jokes are, they're not like that much of a thing, really, are they?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I've never heard that.
Are they like super violin jokes, the way there are like viola jokes?
I'm sure it's related to like being diva or
demo. Yeah.
The world revolving around you or something.
I can only think of like slightly the less clean pianist jokes. So,
okay.
I'm going to go.
So based on your experiences recording for different record labels like Naxos and Chandos, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Chandos.
Chandos.
Yeah.
Is there a difference when working with one or the other? Which one has offered a better deal? You can tell us. It's okay.
Like business deal?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, actually, there's huge differences between them. So Naxos, was the one that really gave me my like entree into the recording world. It was my first project when I did the Handel keyboard suites. And they hadn't been recorded so much on piano. They had them on harpsichord. And a friend of mine had said, conductor friend had said, you know, you really got to work out your own project and like look for something that you love and want to do, but it's a bit different. I remember you know, I found the recording of the Handel Keyboard Suites, which were recorded by Sviatoslav Richter and Andrei Gavrilov, who was a bit of a protege of Richter. They recorded them together. I remember finding that record when I was a kid and being like, oh, I didn't even know Handel wrote keyboard suites. You know, we all know the French suites of Bach and English suites and all this other stuff. That's where I knew them from. So when I thought about what can I record that I love and is different, and I thought, oh, yeah. So I went back to that early experience of those Handel. Well, they're called the eight great keyboard suites. He wrote many more, actually, but these are sort of like the big sets. And so I pitched the idea to a friend of mine who worked for Naxos. He took it to Klaus Heyman, the CEO, and they went for it. But it was like I had to produce it. It was like that model where you give us the master, we'll do the rest. Advertise it, we'll get it out there. So I managed to convince Birmingham City Council to fund it. The Symphony Hall in Birmingham, which is like unbelievable space that they built that for Simon Rattle when he came to the city of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. It's very similar to Kimmel Center in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. The look of it, I think it was the same designer and the same acoustician. It was an incredible hall. And they basically just gave me the space over the summer, a couple of days to record as like the prodigal son returning to Birmingham and all this kind of stuff. I just got like amazing generosity from people to produce it. And I got an engineer, fantastic engineer, Jonathan Allen from Abbey Road Studios.
Oh,
who
wow.
He used to work for EMI before EMI disappeared, but he was still at Abbey Road. And he would do like mobile engineering. So he would bring all the equipment, like the mics. He'd have the whole computer set up and everything. And it just happened that we just totally clicked because the way EMI used to record sound was one of my favorite sound production, the old EMI recordings.
Yeah.
And it was just like a certain microphone setup, like one really close in, but then also like omnidirectional picking up the acoustics so that then you can mix them together in post-production. I just had like a really specific idea of how I wanted it done. And I said to Jonathan Allen, and he just knew exactly what I meant immediately because he was just, that's what he'd done for years with EMI. So he was just like, this is my jam. This is my bread and butter. Nailed it first time. I was just like, yep, that is the sound. That was really awesome. Just like cut out all this time. What was interesting though, I had complete control over my Naxos project to the point where like exactly how it sounded. I mean, I went in afterwards. He basically just gave me every single take. Literally like hundreds of takes, and I listened to all of them. I knew exactly which ones I wanted. I knew what I wanted where, if this movement was the best for this one, this movement was the best for this one. And I went into Abbey Road Studios and I just sat with him. I had it planned. I was like this, and we just banged it out in like an hour. Wow. He's doing it on there, just got the editing done. I knew exactly what I was producing. It was like really hard work, but like really satisfying. I just felt like I had executive control over this project.
Yeah.
And then, weirdly enough, my connection to Shandos came through that project because then Naxos asked me to perform at, I think it was their 25th anniversary at Steinway Hall, the old Steinway Hall. And it just happened that the head of Shandos was there, liked what he was hearing. And I played a particular piece. I played the Islame of Balakirev, and he was like, oh, I want you to record that for us, like that piece.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh, so I've got to find a way to incorporate that. That's when I realized that he's like one of the mighty handful, you know, like Balakirev, Rimsky-Korsakov, Borodin, Mussorgsky, and Sezakui, probably the least known of all of them. And I thought, okay, so I'll record pictures in an exhibition for Mussorgsky, Balakirev, Islami. These are like the stalwarts, they're like real favorites. And then I found this like unusual stuff of Borodin and Rimsky-Korsakov. So that kind of like packaged the idea, right? And then at first it was like, oh, this is the relief. I don't have to worry about editing this. They just book you, they tell you to come in, 2 days of recording, and then you're going to get the first edit. You know, so then you get the first edit, you make a few comments, with like this changed, but it's the producer that makes the decisions about, well, I'm going to use this take. You know, they'll have notes of like what you expressed in the session.
Yeah.
So like I said, that was my favorite take. Suddenly it was like a bit, like actually I kind of want the control back.
Yeah.
In the sense of like, oh, this is less stressed in a way, almost like relinquishing the controls. It's like you're trading one for the other. I think probably ultimately the trade is the best. It's so tiring to like do the whole thing. It was amazing the first time, but I'm not sure I would want to do it again, actually.
And our thing is like we've practiced hours and hours and hours and hours to get a good product, and then these people have hours and hours and hours of experience of putting it all together.
And you know, they do have amazing ears. The producer at Shandos was fantastic, like such a great guy, like incredible ears. They know how to string it together. So I think you do sort of have to just, you know, sort of like, step back and just accept.
Trust. Trust. You have to trust them, yep.
It's like, I sort of equate it to like the difference, you know, when there's certain like film directors who just cannot relinquish the editing, like they have to do it all. But then I think it was Woody Allen who, Susan E. Morse was his editor, and he just trusted us so much that like she knew exactly
what he wanted.
How to like piece it together and just like get it perfect. So I think, you know, when you're lucky that you team up with the right people. So definitely a shout out to Jonathan Cooper, who was the producer for that recording. And the producer for Crudiana recording is Silas Brown, who's another total genius. Just, the guy is brilliant. I've never seen someone like so switched on.
We can't wait until that.
Yeah, really excited to get the first edit. I think to get the first edit this month, and then we'll work to complete it, and then it'll be sent off to the next one. So I don't know yet exactly the street date, but you know, hopefully by the fall I'll at least know when it's awesome. Going to be coming out. So.
Getting a little more personal now?
Sure.
What inspires you?
I think my past, my family, my mom definitely, who's no longer with us, sadly. I remember certain things she would say, you know, and it's still like, oh yeah, that's something to aim for. Other kinds of art inspire me, like movies inspire me, different genres of music, David Bowie. I think I've come to sort of really cherish what I do more than ever, in a sense, coming through the pandemic and everything. I think, you know, when it's taken away, you sort of start to really see its value. I mean, like going back to someone like my mother, I just remember the total pleasure music would give her. You know, it's like I can still remember the pieces that I would play for her. You create memories with music and art, right? These sort of memories of people, places. So I kind of see it as all as one, right? You know, your life experience informs your art, and then vice versa.
But does your mom have a particular quote?
Not specifically about music, but I remember the one thing she used to say just about happiness in general. She said, mm-hmm. there's no greater gift than just finding happiness in something really simple. Mm-hmm. And she would just love to walk, and she would like say, oh, like just that tree over there would just like give her contentment or happiness in that moment. I had no idea what she was talking about at the time. I was just like,
you thought she lost her mind?
Yeah, like, what are you talking about, mom? When you're a certain age and you just kind of, no, that doesn't make sense. But now it's like some of the best advice I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to forget that. And you know, you get like embroiled in worrying about these things that are really just out of our control at the end of the day, you know.
Yep.
And usually, I heard a great quote recently as well where someone said, life rarely works out as bad as you feel it is going to, but also rarely works out as good as you hope it's going to. We tend to like over worry about things, you know, you sort of think, oh God, this is the end of my world, you know, this is terrible. And that's like rarely true. Obviously, tragic things happen, you know, and you know, sometimes life does just throw a curveball and you never expected that to have like the worst to happen, you know, sometimes it does, but you always find a way through it, right? And it's never quite that thing that you envisaged it was going to be, like, you know, when you're a kid you just like have this idea of, like, but then and it just keeps surprising you though, and then sometimes it's better. Yeah. And then sometimes it's a bit worse, but yeah, I just remember my mom saying that. And the other thing she said was, the greatest gift is just to learn how to really enjoy being by yourself.
That's
helped during this pandemic. Yeah. I tell you. And actually helped me a lot when I was just like traveling around performing sometimes, because you know it is lonely. You guys know it's lonely. Yeah. You're on a plane by yourself tons of times. You're in hotels by yourself. I think just to be able to actually cherish those moments is really important, and then making experiences out of them instead of like sitting there and just thinking, oh, this sucks, I'm by my own, I wish I had someone to share this with. You like create the memory, and then you can share that with someone at some other point or whatever. So yeah, the people inspire me more than anything, I think. I tied in with just like the whole life experience.
Mm-hmm. What gives you hope?
People.
Politicians?
Definitely not politicians. they give me the opposite, I guess. If I had to like designate myself, I would say that I'm a extroverted introvert. I think I'm like primarily an introvert, but like I'm quite an extroverted guy. Like I really enjoy socializing, I love people, I love talking, you know, but a lot of my experiences are sort of my own. I'm quite protective of them. I'm like, mm-hmm. you know, it's like very personal to me, and I feel that like really strongly. I think everyone does, in a way. I think probably all of us do that more than we even know or even think, and we've probably found that even more during this time of like forced isolation, right? But yeah, I think what gives me hope is that somehow, like, even if politicians are screwing it up, or you know, things are somehow, like, people do still seem to persevere, mm-hmm. right? Just like human beings, we seem to have a way of persevering, and we seem to have a way of finding beautiful things, whether it's art, you know, music, you know, film, whatever it is, photography, something that like captures an amazing moment. we will always have the desire to find it. Mm-hmm. And even though, like, during the, like, very, I'm sure everyone can relate, during this time, there's like, oh my God, is art ever really going to come back in the same way? By the way, I actually don't think it will come back in the same way. It'll just be different. And I think that's something we all have to deal with as artists. I don't think we can hold on to the hope that it's going to be what it was. We just have to know it's going to be something different. And we all have to be a part of whatever that difference is.
Yeah.
But I think what does give me hope is that I just feel like as human beings, we need to find the good and like the beautiful stuff. And so I think we'll just keep finding a way. So that definitely gives me hope.
And do you have any fears?
Probably too many to list. No, I mean, not anymore, actually. I sort of have the fear of kind of, I could bring out the most overused quote in ever, right? That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Yeah. But there is like such a truth to it. And I don't want to like over sort of analyze, you know, and sort of like sound too cliche about the experience of like having COVID and all this sort of stuff, you know, but I've lost friends during it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I had it myself, that idea of kind of like having something that has killed your friends is just bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I remember like when I just was in the middle of it, I was kind of like, the only thing that I didn't like fear, like, but it did make me stop and think, because I was like, okay, this isn't going to finish me. But it did make me think that, like, if it was, like, what would I regret? And I think I feared regretting things, and it wasn't the things that I'd ever done or said, it was the things I hadn't said or done.
Your bucket list.
Yeah, just things to say to people. Mm-hmm. Or things to do. When it's all said and done, those are the things that you regret. Actually, not the things you've done and the things you said, but the things that you didn't. And it's a really hard thing, because then you're kind of like, it's so easy to slip back into your comfort zone, right? Even when things open up, you sort of tell yourself these grand, like, oh, I'm going to tell everyone like how really what they mean to me. Or I'm gonna, yeah, so, and then when life comes back, you find yourself easily slipping back into your MO, your modus operandi. I fear like regretting certain things. That's my biggest fear, I think. Yeah, I won't think I've done enough or like experienced enough. Or
yeah, we got it.
Floundering a little bit, but there you go.
So, what could we be doing differently as musicians to play a more prominent role in society?
That's a really good question. Yeah, we sort of already are, in a sense, I guess, because of the whole movement of social media and Instagram and Facebook. Everything is kind of by just virtue of the fact that it is so much more interactive, we already are. But I think as classical musicians, I've been thinking a lot about how we can all be a part of what it means in the future now, especially now when it is just going to be changed. In its function, it's going to be different, and in the way it's perceived by people, it's going to be different because of how everyone's lives have been changed, you know. And I think everyone's thinking about their lives, priorities, and what's important. We can be part of a movement to recognize that fact. And like, how do we fit into that? Like, how can we be of service in a way to those people? And I think we can do it in maybe like democratizing a little bit more, to use a sort of bit of a buzzword. Maybe we can all be a bit more involved in not just relying on the traditional presenters and the traditional halls and, you know, sort of hoping in the sense that we can just get ourselves out there. And, you know, maybe there's somewhere where it can be a bit more communal, you know, where we're sort of working together more. I mean, you guys have done it with New Doctor, right? You've already done that. I think you've been a part of that idea of starting your own festival. How do we get people more involved? So that's something I've been thinking about, because I don't have the answer yet of exactly how I'm going to do that or how we should be doing it. But I think just to start the conversation in a way, because I think I've been guilty as well of just, you know, you have your track and you get kind of like single-minded on your track.
Mm-hmm.
And then that track is suddenly taken away. And maybe you start to like see it in a different way.
Yeah.
You start to realize, well, what are the parts of the track that I really actually want to get back on? Maybe I don't actually want to get back on all of them.
Yeah.
You know? It's absolutely. Like I thought I did at the time, but maybe I don't now. It's like, so we have this opportunity where we can say, actually, what do I want my career to be? What are my priorities? What do I want it to mean to other people? What do I want to be remembered for? It's like, it's almost like an opportunity has been presented where I don't necessarily just want to hop right back on. Pick and choose maybe a little bit more. Obviously, that is hard when it's your livelihood and,
yeah.
You know, you've got to do what comes along so often. But yeah, I think there is a way of just guiding it a little bit more yourself and just supporting others to do the same. We've all got to find a way through this together.
Yeah.
I don't think we can do this alone. Exactly how that's going to happen, we'll sort of find that as we go along.
Yep, just keep building each other up, man. That's all we can do.
Yeah, absolutely. We're in it together. There's no doubt about it.
Could you name three people that have influenced and helped you to get to where you are now, and why?
Well, my mother. This has to be. I include my father in that, but I'll put those as one, as like one unit. Yeah, I remember all the sacrifices, you know, taking me to my piano lessons all the way to London every Tuesday. My mum would sit outside and she'd go off for walks like until it was over, and then she'd take me home again, you know, every single Tuesday without fail. It's like something that you don't quite realize at the time, and then that was...
Especially with seven kids, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. Yeah.
You know, yeah, so I think of all the ways that, like, the sacrifices they made and sort of helped me make. My teacher, Philip Martin, he was like my sort of first piano teacher outside of my father, and I remember he kept it really fun. He was like such a great guy. And yeah, introduced me to playing his music. So yeah, he made a definite, really big impression. I think I'd have to also include my teacher at the Royal Academy of Music, remembering, you know, like that experience on stage and the things I think that you still remember to this day. And I'm sure there's just so many others.
Yeah.
Even just like individuals who sometimes just say one thing to you, one piece of advice, you know, you sort of remember for the rest of your life. But yeah, those are sort of three of the main ones.
So a lot of people listening will want to check out your website and rush to their app to follow you on social media. Can you tell them to where they can find you?
Yeah, so philipedwardfisher.com. I will soon be updating my website. Philip Edward Fisher, one word, on Instagram. Official page on Facebook, Philip Edward Fisher, or just Philip Fisher is my personal page. The two sort of work in conjunction these days. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I post a lot on my personal page. Those are the usual ways.
No Twitter?
I haven't used Twitter in ages. I do have an account, which is, I think, P.E. Fisher. I literally haven't used it in the longest time. I'm actually not a big Twitter fan.
LinkedIn,
yeah, Philip Fisher.
We're seeing a theme here.
I'm not a big Twitter fan. I don't trust it. Mm-hmm. I hate the idea of 40 characters somehow saying anything meaningful. it's such a minefield.
Mm-hmm. It's ruined a lot of people for sure, especially actors and actresses.
Yeah, yeah, and there's so much negativity on it as well. I mean, yeah. You know, I think it is a great thing in many ways. Like, you know, you just hear someone just quips and says something, you know, but I've just seen so much like fighting and like animosity and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not quite my thing to Twitter. I could never quite like get to grips with it. Some people are great at it, right? They just know how to like just condense something and like say something meaningful, but it was never quite my thing.
So we're at the end of the show. There's always so much more to talk about, but we will let you go.
Great. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Any final words you want to share with us, with people listening that we haven't covered?
Yeah, I guess I would just say, you know, anyone who's listening, I would include all of us, not just musicians, anyone who's listening. We've all been through this together. This time is just the weirdest time I can remember. I'm sure that just goes for so many. Then I'm sure there are generations who've lived through worse. You know, there's always that perspective. If it's like in some small way, it inspires and you can pass that on to someone else. So I think that's the time we're in right now. We've just got to find like whatever nuggets of hope just keep us going. And I just, thanks for listening, because I tend to go on.
So we love having you on the show. Thanks for joining Ian and I.
Yep.
Down the pit. We love your playing and have great respect and admiration for you as a person, and have truly enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure. Both of you guys were great. I love what you guys are doing with the podcast, so keep it going.
Thank you, Phil.
Take care.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for sticking around until the end and allowing us to be a part of your day. We don't have all the solutions to the world's problems, but classical music for sure can help solve a few of them. Please follow us on social media, and we cannot wait for you to join us next time.